Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. We're going to do a little bit of year in review. That's a popular thing to do, but we're going to try to do it from a Catholic perspective, and that means some of the stories that you have heard a lot about this year, we'll try to give the perspective from a Catholic point of view, but also some stories that you maybe haven't heard much about at all, but are pretty important stories to those who are Catholic, or in some cases who are just sane, but our news media missed them. We'll try to get to all of those. I am Cy Kellett, your host. We're going to do this over a couple days, actually, and this will be the first day. It's going to roughly mirror the first half of the year, but we'll talk about whatever we want, really. And then tomorrow we'll do roughly the second half of the year. And so joining me in studio today are Todd Agliolaro, the director of publishing at Catholic Answers. Hi, Todd.
Hey, sorry.
Thank you for coming in to do this.
Looking forward to it.
And also Tim Ryland, editor of Catholic Answers Magazine, one of the finest Catholic magazines. The reason I say one of, because I don't read all of them, but of the ones that I read, it's the finest. But there might be a finer
one.
Well,
we appreciate
that. I don't know.
Thanks, Cy. There might be. I don't know either.
Are you just, while I'm introducing you, looking at the current issue of Catholic Answers Magazine?
Yeah, I just brought it in so I can gaze at it.
That's nice.
Lovingly.
That's the ABCs of apologetics?
Yeah, A through Z of apologetics.
A through Z. I still don't know what Z is. I got the magazine.
You
and
got
I
the magazine.
And I forgot to look.
I'm not going to tell you.
All right. Let me just start here, if I may.
Please.
Scale of 1 to 10. Well, you don't have to do it on a scale of 1 to 10. How bad a year was this for Christians? Anybody? It does. I mean, we have trust in the Lord and all that, but some years are better than others. So that means some years are worse than others. This seemed like a bad year for Christianity in general.
Well, certainly for Catholicism.
Okay. All right.
I mean, I think Catholic Christians have really taken body blows almost on a weekly basis for the last many months here.
Yeah.
The headlines today. Illinois.
I know more, just
a deluge.
It seems like it's going to be years now. I mean, now that these attorneys general are doing their thing and they'll get stuff out, and I don't begrudge them anymore.
No.
I just feel like get it all out. It doesn't all come out at once. It's this state or that state and I don't know if you both know this, but there are 50 states. So did you know that it was up to that many? And so
I had no idea.
Some of them are Commonwealth, so
that is true. That is right. Like the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I think my birth state, Pennsylvania, is Commonwealth.
I think you're right.
Is it Commonwealth? What do you think, Todd? How bad a year was it?
Well, historical perspective is maybe helps temper that a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, not too many people get eaten by lions this past year or being burned at the stake, so that's a good thing.
That is a good thing, yeah.
But for sure, the body blows was a good term that Tim just used. For Catholics especially, it's been one just gut-wrenching discouragement after another, it seems, doesn't it?
It really is discouraging. I think that's the effect of it is discouragement.
Right.
How do you counter that?
Well, one thing that I certainly emphasize with I have non-Catholic friends that I get together with on occasion, and I got hammered pretty hard the last time we got together. What gets lost in the headlines is the fact that so much of this abuse happened decades ago.
Okay.
You know, you see 260 priests, et cetera. But if you read down near the bottom of the inverted pyramid, as they call it in journalism, you see that some of these cases are 20, 30 years old. In fact, the majority of them are. And since the first wave of scandal hit in 2002, the church, certainly in the U.S. especially, has really cleaned up its act or
– So there's some encouragement there. The fact is the scope maybe not so much, but we did know in 2000 – by 2002, 2003, 2004, as things unfolded, okay, there have been decades of problems. And so your view is we are in a better position now than we were in 2002.
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough. Do you have anywhere you take encouragement?
I took your question to mean how do you counter discouragement? So which are we referring to? How to counter attacks about the church on the church regarding the recent scandals, or how to counter discouragement in your own heart?
Yeah, let's try the latter. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's tough. I mean, you have to be grounded, right? You have to have core convictions about not only about the truth of the propositions that make up Catholicism, because you can have that intellectually and still be shaken in your will to the point where you you stray from the faith. And mm-hmm. I've known people who have done that, and it wasn't over intercession of the saints or Mary or purgatory or the Eucharist. It was something in their heart. So beyond having that intellectual conviction and having it strongly, there has to be a sense of hope. There has to be a sense of final victory that we know we're assured that Christ has promised us.
All right.
It borders on the superficial sometimes to say gates of hell won't prevail.
Right.
The victory has won, all that. But I think you let that pass and you realize there's an important truth to that.
Yeah. Okay. Was it Tolkien that had the line about the Catholic history is just a long series of defeats ending in total victory?
Yeah, that's right. And it's the word he coined was eucatastrophe, the good catastrophe. And he, if you read his fiction, it's the plots of his stories are so many of them are set up. So many of the scenes and the stories within a story of the Lord of the Rings, for example, are constructed in a way that there's the verge of defeat, and then some unforeseen good or some unforeseen help or aid comes to lead you to victory. Yeah,
and we've seen that in the history. I mean, I guess you could think of Saint Francis and Dominic. You might go, "Wow, you're really going back there," but okay. But it is in fact the history of the church. Mm-hmm. The church looks in rough shape at the time of Francis and Dominic, but what bright lights emerge out of that? What tremendous bright lights in the Dominicans and the Franciscans?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the only example? Did I just come up with the only example of
the Counter-Reformation?
Right. Philip Neri and Loyola and Teresa of Avila and all of that.
So yeah, right? Historically, in times of darkness, as Todd says, as Tolkien puts it, you know, the reinforcements come galloping over the hill, or the shining light begins to break forth. So maybe there's something to that. Maybe there's some sense of lack of, you know, or for some hope, lack of discouragement. If you think, okay, well, what good can God bring out of this evil? Because He always does.
Yeah.
And on the off chance that Chris hasn't already mentioned it, or actually he's going to be tomorrow.
Yeah.
Lepanto, Gates of Vienna.
Let me just give you a preview. Any conversation with Chris is going to include a mention of Lepanto. So
I preempted him.
Yes, right. So things can look awfully, awfully dark.
I mean, just in the history of Catholic struggle against Islam, other than Lepanto and Vienna, you've got
Charles Martel
at Poitiers, Battle of Tours. You've got Skanderbeg and all the everything he did in the Balkans. I mean, there's probably a dozen of these you could list if you got a little deeper into it.
I really like the way Todd pronounces French words. How do you feel about that,
Tim? It's because he speaks French.
Oh,
actually, the trick is just purse your lips and speak English. Yeah.
Okay, so we talk about it being a bad year because of these internal things. I will just briefly mention a schism developed, or a schism, however you pronounce it.
If you're Jimmy Akin, it's schism.
Schism, yeah. Really? Yeah. Or
Shamil, Shamazel.
Chism Bob. Remember Chism Bob? That was a way of doing math. I don't know how it worked, but
Among the
Orthodox is what I meant to say. Between the Russians and the Greeks, a real tragedy, a horrible thing. There are other wounds. I mean, the ongoing de-Christianization, and I want to point to this year Ireland had a vote on a proposition in which really – I mean, technically the choice is somewhat complex, but basically what they were voting on was shall we have abortion or shall we not? And they said we shall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Ireland. It's just another sign of de-Christianization this year.
They're funding them with public money too, so it's just.
Well, they're quick, aren't they?
They're not wasting any time. Yeah.
Wow. So the de-Christianization continues apace this year. It was not a good year as far as, and maybe this is some of that good catastrophe in the sense that there is an element of falseness that can develop. Certainly, that developed in Ireland with the clericalism and all of that, and maybe there is a need for a winnowing or something. I don't know. Maybe we need these catastrophes, but nonetheless, there doesn't make them not catastrophes.
Right. It's true. And there may, by the same token, that there's certainly confusion within the Catholic Church itself for various reasons right now. And
right.
maybe that, again, maybe that's needed. Maybe clarity will emerge. That's what right. you have to hope, because it seems things seem to seem pretty dim sometimes.
They do. Todd, you were going to say something? No. Okay. So former Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Emeritus Benedict, long ago suggested, decades ago, that what we might be looking at is a time of the shrinking of the church.
Right.
Do you think he's prescient in that regard? Do you think that's what's happening? You don't.
Well, gosh, it's become almost almost a truism now in a lot of Catholic circles.
Yeah.
I just read a headline just a few minutes ago that a diocese in the Netherlands, Utrecht, I think, I'm not pronouncing it correctly, is going to be closing most of its parishes.
Uh-huh.
The empty churches in Western Europe, the to go back to Ireland, its stunning fall from the jewel of Catholicism, you know, a place that sent missionaries all over the world, this
right.
tiny little island, had such an outsized impact on the faith, certainly in this country and much of the English-speaking world, in a generation from sending its surplus priests around the world to not having enough people filling the pews to keep parishes going. But you know, before I forget this, the counterpart to that is, lest we're tempted to look at Ireland and see there a kind of paradigm for all of Europe, all of the church, look on the other side of the continent, and you see places like Poland and Hungary.
Right, right.
Where, for whatever reason, maybe because they learned their lesson suffering under communism,
mm-hmm.
they don't want to go back. So they've seen where that road leads,
yeah,
and they're eager to avoid it, or for some other reason they are taking steps to ward off that kind of legislation and that direction that much of the rest of Europe has gone in. So all is not despair there, I don't think.
Right. That's a very good point. Certainly signs of hope in Eastern Europe. It does seem. But now you know France. It seems like even in France there is, though maybe very small, there are people who are taking the Catholic faith seriously again. There seems to be a – am I correct in that, or is that – have you not heard any news?
Well, I don't profess to be an expert. From the bits and pieces I pick up, we've had visitors here at Catholic Answers, as you recall. We've had Bishop Jean-Dominique of the Diocese of Fréjus-Toulon. I think that's all the French I can say here. But came and visited us and spoke of signs of hope there. We had a visit from a priest from the Communauté de l'Emmanuel in Versailles, who visited us just a few months ago. In fact, we had a nice sit down with him, and one of the areas where he seemed to indicate that there was revival was liturgically in France. And we were talking about challenges that we faced, and he talked about atheism, he talked about Islam, not so much anti-Catholic Protestantism in France. But I made some kind of reference to clown masses or silly liturgies, and he just kind of made a very French face and scoffed, because in France they don't have such things. You know, they may not be many people in the pews, but they still do
liturgy.
Liturgies are
reverently.
Beautiful and traditional. And I think perhaps an analog to that, I don't know, is the support for traditional marriage that was recently manifested there
right.
About a year ago, I think. Many hundreds of thousands of marchers, the Manif pour tous, they call it, where you'd be shocked that a nation famous in our imagination for sexual libertinism would rally up support for traditional marriage in a way that a country like ours, many times bigger, failed to do.
Yeah, all right.
So maybe that's a good sign too.
All right. Mm-hmm. I have to take a break. I want you to know that we mentioned one of the finest Catholic magazines in the world, that is Catholic Answers Magazine. A great way to start the new year is to get a subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine. Maybe get it for a seminarian you know, maybe for your priest or a family friend, or a student that you know. Right now, when you sign up, you get a free digital subscription to load onto your tablet computer or other or mobile device. Sign up now at CatholicAnswersMagazine.com.
Got questions? Visit us today at Catholic.com.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
When you engage with the wisdom of saints this way, it stokes the fires of God in our hearts, encourages us, strengthens us, and gives us wisdom to deal with the difficulties of life. It also gives us wisdom that allows us to rise above all of the junk, to live with joy and peace in the midst of even the most difficult circumstances.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're reviewing the year 2018 for a couple days here, and we begin with this hour with Tim Ryland, the editor of Catholic Answers Magazine, and Todd Aguilaro, the director of publishing here at Catholic Answers. We're going to talk about some of both of your successes in those regards this year. I'll surprise you with it, with my laudatory comments later, but they're going to be gushing. All right.
I'm looking forward to that.
They better be.
Get ready for some laudatory gushing. We've got.
That's my second favorite kind of gushing, by the way.
Really? The other kind is that gum with the soft center.
It involves chocolate, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. We've got an emeritus pope and a pope. I don't know what – I guess I should probably just should have said pope. So let me ask a couple questions about them in the year 2018. Early in the year, Pope Benedict made some news with a letter in which he said he's beginning or he's in the stage of his final pilgrimage home. He remains with us, praise God. But what do you make of – I mean he is – it's for so many of us, beloved Pope Francis – I mean excuse me, beloved Pope Benedict – he's not going to go on forever, but I feel like he's still playing an important role in the church. Either of you have a sense of that or no, you think he's playing no role at all. Okay,
well,
that's fine.
I think he's certainly a touchstone for those people who long for his pontificate.
Oh, well, yeah, that's true. Right.
The fact that he's still alive somehow, I think is significant.
Yeah.
Once he passes, it's sort of a new era.
Okay. Yeah.
It's an interesting time because it's a new era when a pope generally one dies and another one comes in. This is a strange sort of hybrid for us, I think.
It is.
So it'll be interesting to see if that what effect that has when he does die.
Now, Todd, you never liked
Pope Benedict.
You're making
a French face at me.
what do you think? Of this season of his life?
Well, he was a giant, and my contact with him in this season of his life is mostly just the pictures of him you see coming across social media from time to time, and he just seems to be shrinking physically. And but there's something very holy about him that comes off in this point of his life. Whereas you didn't think of him perhaps unjustly for his holiness so much when he was the pope.
Brilliance was always
the thing. You thought about his intellect, right? And rightly so. And he seems to just, even as he physically shrinks, he has this kind of beatific look to him now that maybe that's his own kind of inspiration.
Yeah, and I have a sense that the role is important too because it does seem with modern technologies and the way the end of life goes now, it's not like medieval death. It's different. This is likely to be a role that we'll see again. And it seems to me he's a little bit the George Washington in this respect. You know, that George Washington showed you how this is how you be an American president, and then you leave after two terms, and you know, unless you're Franklin Roosevelt. But he seems to me to be actually doing something that's very, very valuable to the church about how one takes on this role that is a very kind of modern role of Pope Emeritus.
Utterly unprecedented for many, many lifetimes. So,
right.
We're still figuring out how to deal with that. I mean, I think that there are some, as Tim hinted a minute ago, who would maybe like to see him be vocal about things. Of course, it's wise that he's not. And it's unfortunate that in the context, again, of the scandals, that journalists and some would kind of pricking him for statements and info, and he's wisely staying out of it.
Yeah.
But that does put a little bit of a damper on the thing you were just talking about on his.
But are we agreed then? Because I agree with Todd on this, that I think it would be a catastrophe for the church if he were somehow a vocal, I don't know, defender of this and that and his legacy or something like that. If he were doing those kinds of ex-president type things, that would be truly a disaster for the church.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so on to Pope Francis. Pope Francis, I don't know if either of you knows this about Pope Francis. Occasionally he will make controversial statements, and some of which drive people crazy. In February, he said that priests should keep their homilies to 10 minutes. Do you remember that this became a thing back in February?
Mm-hmm.
I'm somewhat sympathetic to him.
I was going to say, he's not always crazy. No, I'm sorry. He's never crazy. But
I know that people take offense, but I kind of feel sympathetic with him on this.
Yeah.
Like, preach on the Gospels or the readings of the day, and in 10 minutes you can do it. Am I wrong?
No, I agree 100%. Right. In fact, it's supremely Catholic, I think, to say something like that. So first, because with longer homilies comes a temptation for the priest to make himself the center. And of course, there are many, many very holy and wise priests who may give a long homily and don't do that. But anyway, that possibility is there. And also the unbalancing of the liturgy as a whole. You associate long sermons with Protestantism, and for good reason, because that message, that lesson, is the substance of the service.
Yes.
Whereas for Catholics, the heart of the service is the sacrifice of Calvary, and the attendant message is just a supporting part, and it needs to be properly proportioned in that way.
Yeah, I think you can also equate long homily sometimes with laziness. I know Todd will understand this as an editor, and you as a former editor.
Laziness, yes.
I understand laziness too. Well done, Todd.
I'm about to make my point here.
Sorry.
You can often take a long article and hone it down to half its length, and it's better for it. In other words, you really have to hit the points, be succinct. And I think a lot of priests don't do that. They don't tend to prepare maybe as much as they possibly could. I guarantee that most 15-minute homilies would be much better as a 10-minute homily.
That is an excellent point. How many times have you found that when you got a word count and then maybe as a writer, an editor said, sorry, it's going to have to be 400 instead of 800 for this issue.
Right.
And when you're all done, you're like, it's better at 400.
Yeah.
Less of me is apparently good. I think that's for a lot of us should discover that. Yeah, that's a good point about editing and preparing. And he has said before things like the deacon or the priest who doesn't prepare his homily is how did he say it? It was a spiritual crime or something. He used very strong language.
Yeah, about it, and it's ironic coming from a pope that often
that speaks off the cuff.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Right. There's a good number of people. The Pope does have a tendency to say things on airplanes that he doesn't say in other places, and do things on airplanes.
Yeah.
So, and I know there are quite a few Catholics who are like, if he would just not talk on airplanes, we'd be okay with him.
Battle,
I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, having a little, it's okay for Catholics to be critical of popes or have a little fun at it. I mean, we have become, in recent decades, very, very Pope-centric as a church.
Yeah, and this is one reason why I have some Eastern Catholic friends who, however much they may take issue with some of the things that Pope Francis says, see in that an opportunity to go back to what a proper balance is when you look at the office of the papacy. And we've had and the media plays a role in this too, but a tendency to view every utterance out of a pope's mouth as oracular.
Yeah.
And perhaps not with bad reason, because we've had two very wise and especially in John Paul II's case, media savvy popes
right
over the last 40 years. So But it maybe it led to some bad habits on the part of Catholics and kind of laziness in itself, to talk of laziness,
yeah,
where you no longer feel a need to stay connected with the tradition, to understand the magisterium as a whole, but you simply wait for marching orders from the Pope, moment. So perhaps this is a welcome and needed correction that we're undergoing now.
Yeah. No, I was going to make that same point, that I think it's clarified the Pope as a man and the Pope qua Pope.
Yeah, the role of the Pope is not the same as the man.
Right.
And it's good for us to get that lesson. Fair
I
enough.
Think so.
We got to take a break. I'm going to talk. I would continue with the Pope Francis discussion because he made a little change to the catechism that upset a bunch of people this year. We'll talk about that when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
The Catholic Church claims to be the religion in which the fullness of truth resides, but at times getting to the heart of any particular question of doctrine or morals can lead not only to personal confusion, but conflict and even disagreement among Catholics. In his new book, Teaching with Authority, Jimmy Akin sets the record straight. Teaching with Authority isn't about understanding specific teachings of the faith, but rather about understanding Catholic teaching itself. A unique, valuable, and long overdue resource for Catholics as well as those inquiring about the faith, Teaching with Authority will help deepen your understanding of what the Church teaches by showing you, maybe for the first time, how, why, and where it does. Get your copy of Teaching with Authority today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
How can a human woman be God's mother? Where in the Bible does it say that Mary was sinless and a perpetual virgin? What can I do to build and deepen my relationship with Mary as my spiritual mother in heaven? In 20 Answers Mary, you'll find biblical evidence for Marian doctrine and devotion, answers to common objections to Catholic teachings about Mary, and guidance on how to imitate Christ as you get to know the Blessed Mother like you've never known her before. 20 Answers Mary is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Tomorrow on More to Life, the life you were meant to live.
We'll look at how the theology of the body can help you live a more abundant life. That's tomorrow on More to Life, 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 Central on EWTN Radio. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Merry Christmas. Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and I love being Catholic for a lot of reasons, but getting to say Merry Christmas for a long time after Christmas Day is one of the great benefits of being Catholic. We're reviewing the year a bit this hour and in the coming hours of this program. Joining me here in studio today are Todd Agliolaro, the Director of Publishing here at Catholic Answers, and Tim Ryland, the editor of Catholic Answers Magazine. Okay, so I gave you a whole break to think about it. Let me just be specific. It was quite controversial in June when there was a revision to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, a document of great lineage. What is it? 25 years old, maybe 30. I mean, it's not an ancient document. It wasn't, right. In other words, I'm being somewhat facetious because it's not like a revision of the Bible. Or the Our Father. Fair enough. We'll get to the Our Father maybe in a little bit. But nonetheless, it would be hard to exaggerate the good that the Catechism of the Catholic Church has done. Mm-hmm. It really helps everybody, especially apostolates like this one. Mm-hmm. You know what? There it is. There's what the Catholic Church teaches on this or that. And so to get a revision of it is jarring, of course, because people have come to rely upon it. But in particular, I think the death penalty, capital punishment, this is a hot button issue, of course. And so at one time, the Catholic Church I would say simply accepted. The death penalty is one of the measures that's part of the enforcement of law and the maintenance of order in society. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it was celebrated, but it was just accepted like any other.
Cooperated part. With it, I think, would be even
cooperated
thing
with
to
it.
Say.
Yeah. Fair enough. Things began to change, and that change was very notable in the papacy of Pope John Paul II.
Right.
You agree with that?
Yes, I do.
So the sainted Pope John Paul II he's the guy that started this, right?
Mm-hmm. I would say so.
I'm trying to lay it at his feet, clearly at his feet, because of his sainted status. That change proceeded apace with Pope Benedict. He seemed perfectly content with the idea that in the modern way of doing things, and given the what modern institutions could do, you didn't need it anymore. So,
well, Pope Benedict took pains to say that different opinions on that were permissible.
Right. Yes.
So I'm not sure how much Benedict advanced.
Okay.
What John Paul had to say in Evangelium Vitae and in the Catechism.
But
fair enough.
Certainly upheld it.
Yeah,
I would say.
Okay, but it does seem that he was making this point in the context of the overall debate about defending life in all of its stages. There's never a time where aborting an unborn child is up for debate.
Right.
That is, there is no diversity of opinions on murder, to put it bluntly.
Mm-hmm.
But so he was making that point. Like, this is the church's teaching on the death penalty is not that. It's not an absolute teaching like that.
It has not been.
Right. So you can certainly disagree with the Pope on the death penalty and still be a good Catholic. Am I correct in that, or am I overstating that? You can disagree with the Pope and be a good Catholic?
Yes, you can.
You don't. Todd doesn't look convinced of that.
Well, my own thoughts on this are still in flux.
Oh, okay.
I know I've talked at length with Jimmy about this, and he would qualify that statement and say that you could – well, to say you're a good Catholic or a bad Catholic, of course, that doesn't mean anything specific. But he would caution against a direct and public dissension against this revision.
Okay.
And the forms that could take, you know, could be many. But and I'm not sure what I think of that either, but that's something for thought anyway.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And that would be the famous Jimmy Akin of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And his – Secret Information Club too. Yeah.
Secret. That's secret. We're not supposed to talk about that. Okay. So now this Pope, Pope Francis, certainly you would say has advanced what had happened under the previous popes, which itself was somewhat of a radical departure or approached a radical departure. And he says now that the entire thing is inadmissible.
That's the word that was added to the catechism.
Inadmissible.
Inadmissible.
The you cannot admit the death penalty. Now, I got so confused about the church's teaching that I simply stopped using the death penalty this year. I did not impose it a single time.
How did that affect your life? Did you notice a change?
It did not change my life in one bit.
The post, right?
But
they say if you don't miss it.
If you don't miss it, then stop worrying about it. But still, this is for many people, I'm thinking of Ed Fazer, one of them. There seems to be the implication being that the church has changed something fundamental here, and that is very dangerous because it makes the entirety of the church's teaching vulnerable to that kind of manipulation.
Yeah, that's been the critique. So
is that the critique?
From a lot of quarters, sure.
Okay.
I mean, most of our listeners probably are aware of it. So
okay.
Fazer and Bessette, I guess Joseph Bessette, his co-author,
okay,
wrote that extensive book on the subject that Ignatius published.
By man shall his blood be shed.
Yes.
Right.
And that was a defense of capital punishment as morally licit, not so much a response to the change in the catechism which came after. But the one part of the critique against the Pope's change here, independently of whether there's merit to discouraging or even calling inadmissible its use, is what the change itself means for other Catholic teachings that we have held to be up to now non-negotiable and set in stone, such as the intrinsic immorality of contraception. I mean, that's the one everyone always goes to.
So if you can change the death penalty, why not?
That's
why can't you change
in
that?
Short, yes.
Yeah.
So that's a tough one.
That doesn't strike me as a dumb critique. That seems reasonable.
No, it's a fair concern, I think, sure.
Yeah, a fair concern. That's a better way to say it, yeah.
Well, it was a bullet that Pope Paul II dodged, you know, the 40, 50 years ago because
Wait, John Paul? Oh, you mean Paul
VI?
I'm sorry,
Paul VI. Blessed Paul VI. Yeah, the commission, the Vatican Commission, you know, that was considering the whole idea of the pill and contraception recommended that the church accept it in some cases.
Right.
And of course, he went against that with his encyclical. We all know, you know, thank God that he did. But I think it's the same type. Yes, there's a fear there. I mean, I think it's a legitimate fear that people have. If you can change one thing, you can change another.
Is it like the little boy taking his finger out of the dike? You know, you allow that. It's just a little bit, but that hole's going to get bigger. And then,
well, there are some who would say the church has changed and is reaping the whirlwind from it now on two issues that some traditionalists like to point to, and that's religious freedom and usury. So certainly the latter being one that defenders of this change and dissenters on Humanae Vitae have trotted out as an example of an area where the church did teach something unequivocally and seems to have reversed itself or at least stopped being so concerned about it. And
But that seems very analogous to this to me in this regard. The world actually changed. I mean, the meaning of money changed with the creation of limited liability corporations and fiat money and all that. So that one can kind of look at that and go, I mean, I'm not making this argument, but it seems reasonable to say, well, the world changed. Money isn't what it used to be, literally isn't what it used to be. And so it has to be thought of differently.
Yeah, I think that's the core of what I think is the proper response to that critique.
Okay.
That not so much the world changed, because you could say the same thing with regard to contraception. Well, the world changed. We don't have agrarian economies anymore where you need to have eight kids, and we have a different view of what sex means and that sort of thing. So the world changing isn't a open and shut answer. But economics changed, the nature of capital changed, and since the teaching on usury is kind of rooted in that, it's fair for that teaching to develop. Whereas the teaching on contraception is rooted in the meaning of human sexuality, the meaning of the marital act, and that is rooted in natural law, which cannot change.
Yeah.
So that attempt to connect the two, and from it demonstrate that the Catholic teaching on contraception could change, I think fails for that reason.
But the analogy then to the death penalty, however, is the world really has changed. I mean, there is a time. I shouldn't say there's a time, because I actually think it's a condition. There's a condition in which human beings can live in which there are not institutions available to protect society. I don't want to say it's a time, because I think it's perfectly possible we could go back to that. I mean, given the state of the world today, we could go back to who knows where we're headed. We're not living in that condition at the moment. At the moment, it does seem that the institutions of the government are able to protect society adequately without resort to the death penalty. Therefore, here is a different way of teaching on the death penalty. Does that hold any water with you?
I think it could be argued that holding someone in prison if they were young and did something heinous and would have gotten the death penalty maybe in an earlier time, to have them rot away in a jail for 60-some years, I don't know about the humanity or the humaneness of that. I mean, people make that argument as well.
Pope Francis has had language that strongly suggests he believes life imprisonment and also to be immoral.
And so, see, there's another red flag for the people who are concerned about this.
I don't think that that's a trivial point, though, that life imprisonment in many cases is such an abominable cruelty that the death penalty doesn't look to be worse.
Well, you know, especially when you consider, and this is one of the arguments that proponents of capital punishment make, that that capital punishment can focus repentance and it can get one's mind and one's heart oriented towards the things that need to be oriented towards in a hurry. and thus lead to their salvation. Whereas a life in prison with a kind of despair that might accompany it could have the opposite effect on his soul. So if your goal in the end is to have a saved soul, there's an argument to be made that capital punishment is superior for that.
Right. Okay. So that does suggest you can see why a lot of people could tolerate, even people who were very pro death penalty, you know, really thought this is a very important part of society, we need to keep it, could tolerate what Pope John Paul had said, that in the modern world it's not necessary, therefore no. The change, however, that Francis made is just no.
Well, right. As Tim said, the language is inadmissible. So there's a lot of hay made about that too.
Oh, okay.
And it's novelty as a moral term. Could I back up one second, real quick? So you mentioned the advances in the technology of incarceration and that sort of thing, and that of course was a huge part of John Paul II's argument.
Right.
And that's a prudential judgment forward to backwards. So there's certainly room to disagree, as many people have established, with a Pope's judgment about any secular prudential question, whether it's who's going to win the NBA championship this year, or whether
Celtics. Oh, I'm sorry.
So I see him, and Pope Francis would say it's going to be the Lakers. So there you go.
Yeah, right.
But I think. There seems to be enough data to make those open questions. So when it comes to the question of defense of society, I've never seen it established in a way that's convincing to me that long ago prisons just weren't very good, and so a murderer, you had to kill him, which is kind of a consequentialist argument when you think about it. I mean, it's a very kind of utilitarian, harsh.
Yeah.
Well, you had to kill him because because our prison bars are too far apart or something, and he'll get out and he'll wreak havoc across the countryside.
Right.
I've never really seen anyone seriously argue that. It just
very
seems to
point.
Be something that we hear and say, well, yeah, we have prisons with lasers now or barbed wire or whatever. But something that fails to take into account, so even apart from that, even if that were true, the fact that someone is in prison doesn't make him completely neutralized as a danger to his fellow prisoners,
no.
For example.
Right.
And we know that violence and even murder within prisons is a serious problem, and even to people outside of prison. Mm-hmm. So there are gang leaders and organized crime leaders who are able to order hits on people on the outside from prison.
And then what you do is you make a new kind of prison, a supermax prison. And then that won't work, and you'll make a supermax prison. And the thing is, people have ingenuity, and it's pretty hard to permanently frustrate human ingenuity.
No, not without so curbing their rights that it would be inhumane.
It's the same as death anyways. Mm. I mean, essential. Well, I shouldn't go that far probably, but we're not going to resolve it, clearly. But I'm glad we took some time to discuss it. It is resolved in this sense. The Pope Rome has spoken, and so we proceed on. But it was something that happened this year, thus we review it, and more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Often unbelievers have a hard time reconciling the doctrine of hell with an all-good God. In fact, I've talked to Catholics who struggle with this. So what can we say to help? Well, first, the punishment of hell is not a kind of vengeance inflicted by God from without, but follows from the nature of sin. All those in hell choose it, and God's respect of man's free will doesn't contradict his goodness. Furthermore, it belongs to God's goodness to make a distinction between loyal and disloyal subjects, and to give their just deserts. What kind of a God would he be if he gave the same reward, heaven, to those who refuse to love him as to those who love him? He wouldn't be a good God. For these reasons, the doctrine of hell is not incompatible with God's goodness. I'm Carlo Broussard with a Ready Reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Morning Glory. It's Catholic from coast to coast.
God doesn't send anybody to help. We choose help. What God is doing is allowing our free will choice, because we have a choice. We can say yes or we can say no. He never wants us to say no. He always wants us to be in love with him. And people need to understand, after we die, you only got two choices, heaven or hell.
Beauty.
Smoking or non-smoking.
Exactly.
Harold Burke Sivers joins Gloria Purvis and the Morning Glory team Monday, January 14th on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're reviewing the year 2018. We can't review 2019 yet unless we have the powers of prophecy and foresight. Either of you? Powers of prophecy and foresight?
I used to.
Jimmy. I used to. I wore them out.
Jimmy Akin has those.
Jimmy. Right. Jimmy knows all. He's okay. All right. So a busy year. We've already discussed and described several of the negative developments of the year. It was a tough year for Christians. And then there were these controversial interior things like the death penalty change and all that. I want to mention to both of you one of the happy things that happened this year. And I might have asked you two. I don't know. I asked some people about their book of the year, what their book of the year. What's the – and Chris Check and I came up with the exact same book as book of the year. And it is a book called Inseparable. Edited and produced by this gentleman right here, Todd Agliolaro. I have been praising it to everyone. I guess what my thought is that people think if it's a book about contraception, and that it's going to somehow be cranky or something. And it's just the opposite. It's a celebration of the beauty of what God has done in creating human beings. I think you did a beautiful job on it, Todd.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a magnificent book. It's a surprising book because I'll be honest with you. I thought a contraception book, I kind of know how those go.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize for that prejudgment. But what a book. Five Perspectives on Sex, Life, and Love in Defense of Humanae Vitae. It's just 50 years too late. That's my complaint. It's exactly 50 years too late. But I say that in the context of this year was the 50th anniversary of Pope Paul VI's Humanae Vitae letter. That was what occasioned this very, very fine book. If I could just say to the listener, it's everything's on sale at shop.catholic.com. So this is on sale. Share it with your young adult children, your teen children. Read it yourself. It gives you a new perspective on just how beautiful the church is teaching on what a human is, what marriage is, and what our sexuality is for. It really does. You wanted to say something?
Well, I was going to say a new book comes out, and even a great book like this, it's sort of, I don't know, a fait accompli. You don't really think about it.
Yeah.
Like, how did this book come to be?
Yeah.
And so I'm just speaking as someone who sits near Todd and overhears things and overhears the genesis of things. And this was really Todd's baby. I mean, we knew we wanted to come up with something for the 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of coming up with different ways of looking at the encyclical from different perspectives.
From five different perspectives,
and
right.
Coming up with the right people to write those. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of work, tremendous amount of time on the phone and editing and everything. So I just want to acknowledge Todd's hard work on that.
That is what we call laudatory gushing. That's what you and I just did. I told you it was.
And yet there are so many who had a part of that. It's funny that you should single me out in that kind way. From the six contributors to the five essays, to my co-editor Stephen Fallon, to Cardinal Burke, who wrote the foreword for it. So this was a meal with many chefs for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe sous chefs, but really only one chef. But,
no.
Okay, so I don't even know if I said that right.
Sous, no, you pronounce it correctly.
Sous chef. Okay. careful with your French around Todd.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so I thought what we'd do is we would rank them 1 to 5, the essays in this book. Todd, you first. No, not really. The thing that occasioned this, the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae, how did you both think the 50th anniversary went? Was it appropriately celebrated in the Catholic Church. I thought we did a good job here, frankly. I thought we did. I thought we did. Mm-hmm. We did a lot on the radio. We talked about it. We had good guests. The publishing did great stuff on it.
We had a magazine.
What'd you think about how the entire issue, the whole world kind of came together and celebrated that Paul VI
for about 2 days.
Yeah. Really? It underwhelmed you?
Well, it was, as they say in, Tim is probably familiar with this journalistic term, OBE, overtaken by events.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And sadly, that's what happened.
That's right. I didn't think about that.
No, I mean, the Cardinal McCarrick thing broke not long after. I think it was completely drowned out, unfortunately. Now, that may not be a tragic thing, because I think there were probably going to be attacks on and critiques of Humani Vitae that would have been a lot of noise in the background too, that and those who would have attacked it were busy doing something else. So maybe that helped a little bit. I don't know.
Well, we'll get to McCarrick in the next hour. Let's not move off too quickly from Humani Vitae, because it's important, because it's like a it strikes one as like a what are those things you toss to someone who's drowning?
A life preserver.
A life preserver. A safety, something that there, where the culture is being swept down a river. It's ugly. It's where it's going. And that this thing is there for people to grab onto if they have a mind to. And it remains seminal. It remains really, really urgent that people not just dismiss, that's the Catholic, the old-fashioned Catholics and their hatred of sex or something.
Right. Well, the word that is always used, and rightly so, it becomes cliche, but it was a prophetic encyclical, because as you read it and you see the ills that he listed that would come as a result of widespread use of contraception, just tick them all off. I mean, you know, use of women as objects, from starting with that, it's all come true. All of it.
It has come. It really has.
And,
And the and worse, frankly.
Sure.
You know, he said.
I think we've gone.
Here's what's going to happen. But he didn't write in there, we're going to say there's no such thing as a boy or a girl anymore.
Right.
He didn't get to that.
Yeah. The fifth essay in Inseparable treats the prophetic part of it. And it's
so that's your favorite one
by Alan Carlson, who's not a Catholic. He was our one non-Catholic contributor to Inseparable, and Carlson, as Chris Cech has called him, is the world's foremost historian of the fallout of the sexual revolution, of which the pill was the engine that drove it. But the second essay in Inseparable by Dr. Paul Gondreau, who is a theology professor at Providence, kind of bookends with that, and he talks about the philosophy of Cartesian dualism, the separation of mind and body, and it's from that all of these other ills spring and flower. So you said we never thought you can call a boy or girl, you know, that would come out of contraception. Well, they have the same root or the same ideological parent.
The kind of a ghost in the machine kind of thing.
That's another good metaphor, yeah. Yes, and this a radical self-autonomy, not only to will what one wills, but to be what one wills to be, simply by willing it, by stating it. And boy, that's the frontier right now. I mean, that's the crisis du jour with transgenderism and all of its associated ills.
It does seem, and this is something I say on the radio program sometimes, it seems like, our apostolate is to explain and defend the Catholic faith. But anymore, before you can even do that, you have to explain and defend reality. We have a very basic job. I mean, in one sense, it makes our job really easy, because reality, that's not, we don't have to be creative, come up with new jobs for ourselves. But, let's leave it on a positive note for this hour. 50 years of Humani Vitae, when the long history of the recovery of sanity is written, Humani Vitae will be recognized as the glorious first step that it was. Amen?
Amen. Amen.
All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more 2018 Year in Review with Todd Agliarlaro, the Director of Publishing here at Catholic Answers, and with Tim Ryland, the editor of Catholic Answers Magazine. Hang on, more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.